Hello and welcome to No Character Limit. My name is Robert Thurk, and today you're going to hear episode 21 of my book entitled Ultima Thule, Unraveling the Unknown. In this episode, you're going to hear all of chapter 13 called Cometary Meteorology. Just as we have been over the last few episodes, we're going to continue on talking about meteors. In the last couple of episodes, I've talked about meteors that come down to Earth as fireballs, large enough to create noise, light, and land intact on the ground. But today's episode's going to be a little different because it's totally dedicated to meteor showers. Meteor showers are different from fireballs because they have their origin in comets. Comets have a special place in our collective psyche because they can light up the sky for days or weeks, and historically, they've been associated with omens and fortunes. For countless generations, people looked up and saw these things in the sky and never knew for certain what a comet actually was. But luckily for us, we live in a time where we've been able to go out and chase comets and reach them and learn what they're comprised of. And what we've found is that they could hold the secrets to the origin of life on Earth. So humans have this deep relationship with not just the comets that we see in the sky, but also their meteor showers that they give us. And I'm going to end this episode with something really special. I'm going to talk about some of the greatest meteor storms ever recorded. This is my favorite section of this chapter because it must have been sublime to witness these incredibly rare events. So I really took the time to focus on testimonials related to meteor storms, because it's likely that you and I will never get to experience such an intense celestial demonstration in our lives. In this chapter, I've shared some really nice pictures that were taken from the missions that we've sent out to comets, and if you'd like to see them, you can always give a donation. I give a free PDF copy of the book. You can also like, rate, review, tell a friend if you've been enjoying this podcast to help spread the word. You can also follow me at NoCharacterLimit at mastodon.world. And finally, you can always reach out to me at NoCharacterLimit at protonmail.com. So, I hope you enjoy this episode today, dedicated totally to comets and their meteor showers. So, let's listen to Chapter 13, Cometary Meteorology. Chapter 13, Cometary Meteorology. Part 1. Space Weather. A person can go their whole life without ever witnessing a fireball like Ensign, but it's not too difficult to spot a more typical meteor in the sky, if you're looking for one. Almost everyone at some point in their life has felt the childlike excitement of catching a glimpse of silver streaking across the sky. The best way to ensure that you will spot a meteor is by catching a meteor shower. Meteor showers are highly predictable events that are never too far off in the future, with at least 10 in the northern hemisphere and about 8 in the southern hemisphere annually. One of the best and most well-known meteor showers are called the Perseids, beginning around the end of July and culminating into a crescendo around mid-August every year. To catch the Perseids, find a spot on a warm, cloudless, and preferably moonless summer night, away from the light and noise pollution of a city. A rare escape in today's modern world. Lay a blanket down on the ground under a wide open sky and lay back and look up into the endless and beguiling abyssal sea. From within a city, you might only see 11 or 12 stars looking into the night sky on any given night, but on a dark, cloudless night without any light, there can be as many as 5,000 stars seen with the naked eye, silently looking back at you from all over the galaxy. And then it happens. A shot across the sky so brief you question whether you even saw it. If it's your first time witnessing it, your body cannot help but to react. This is such a universal reaction that even after someone has seen a shooting star multiple times, they still can get excited by it. But with a meteor shower like the Perseids, you can get your fill, seeing anywhere between 50 to 100 meteors whiz across the sky on any given night. A free celestial performance for anyone willing to just pause and observe for a while. Racing into the atmosphere at over 130,000 miles per hour, Perseids fry into dust at temperatures over 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, around 60 miles above your head. But the most ironic thing is that most meteors from meteor showers never end up hitting the ground, which means they never produce any meteorites. This is because meteor showers only really occur when the Earth comes in contact with a debris field from a comet. The meteors that come from a comet are a completely different animal from the chondrites that come from asteroids, the iron cores of long-dead planets, or the achondrites from other worlds. One way to visualize the difference between an asteroid and a comet is that if an asteroid is a giant rock floating through space, then a comet is more like a giant iceberg floating through space. And like an iceberg on Earth, comets can get very dirty and come in highly irregular shapes. But because a comet has been around a lot longer than any iceberg, it's covered in a lot more dust and dirt. The largest comets are only a few dozen miles wide, so they never get big enough to start forming a more spherical shape like a planet. They're made of rock, dust, frozen water, and other frozen gases like carbon, methane, and ammonia. The comet that the Perseids come from is called Swift Tuttle and is relatively large at about 16 miles across, which is larger than 99% of asteroids. Swift Tuttle also happens to be the largest close object that passes by the Earth. Swift Tuttle is a foreigner, like all comets, as they pass through the inner solar system from the frozen reaches of space. As comets approach the inner solar system, a tail begins to form to announce their arrival into hostile territory, as solar radiation begins to attack it. Their long tail, produced by the melting of gases getting closer to the sun, can extend for thousands of miles, despite the comet only being a few miles across. Swift Tuttle last passed by the Earth in 1992, and could be seen with binoculars at the time. Last seen, it was on its way back to deep space, out of the inner solar system, past the gas giants to disappear into the inky depths again. Neptune, the last planet in the solar system, is about 30 astronomical units away from the sun, which puts this distance about 30 times farther from the sun than Earth. Out here is where the Kuiper Belt begins and goes on to extend nearly twice the distance between the sun and Neptune, ending at about 50 astronomical units away from the sun. In that expansive 20 astronomical unit ring, there is nothing except a slightly higher amount of space debris than most other places in the solar system. The Kuiper Belt is a distant boneyard left behind from the days of the birth of the sun, where dwarf planets quietly compete for domination. A wild west when compared to the much more tightly ordered inner solar system. It's estimated that about 10% of the material floating around in the Kuiper Belt is of interstellar origin, much more ancient than the more common 4.6 billion-year-old chondrite material found in most places around the solar system. Swift Tuttle will travel to the far lonely edge of the Kuiper Belt, 50 astronomical units away, before being coaxed ever so subtly back to the sun. In the depths of the Kuiper Belt, Swift Tuttle blends in with any of the other asteroids silently circling the sun, and despite knowing its exact location and pointing our best equipment at it, it appears to vanish completely into the blackness of space. It's only when a comet returns back to the inner solar system does it grow out its tail once again, on brilliant display, but with a caustic consequence. The tail is created by the nuclear radiation of the sun, which melts the dirty snowball and gases are blown away from the sun by its solar wind, and melting the comet. This means a comet's tail is always pointed away from the sun, even when a comet is also facing that direction, making it less of a tail and more of a horn. The solar winds from the sun are powerful, and in order to survive in the inner solar system, a magnetosphere and atmosphere can go a long way, which is precisely why the Earth fits so well here. It takes 133 years for Swift Tuttle to make that journey from the edge of the Kuiper Belt and back again at spectacular speed. As it races toward the sun, only to get flung back out to the depths of the Kuiper Belt again, it crosses right over the Earth's orbit. This is sort of like a small car traveling directly across a race car loop, while people inside the car throw garbage out the window onto the track, and a semi-truck is barreling around the loop at top speeds. It's most likely that the car and the semi-truck are going to miss each other, and the semi-truck will only run over the garbage left on the track. Of course, this track is 584 million miles long, and this 16-mile-wide car crosses the track only a couple times every 133 years. All comets leave a wake of debris in the inner solar system, just like the garbage from the car. As the Earth drives through the debris, like the semi-truck drives over the garbage, it causes meteor showers. Most of the debris a comet leaves behind is hardly greater than a speck of dust, and the reason they cannot survive the fall to Earth like chondrites, achondrites, and iron meteorites. Like a group of tiny insects hovering in the air ahead of the Earth's windshield, the dust particles left behind by Swift Tuttle and other comets create the annual meteor showers like a smattering of bugs on glass. When most of comet debris hits the atmosphere of Earth, they are usually no larger than pebbles. And because of the size of the debris being so small, when they hit the atmosphere, they burn up well in advance of hitting the ground, making it difficult for us on Earth to better understand comets. Comets have interested scientists not just for having highly elliptical orbits that extend far out beyond the planets, but also because the path of their orbits are unusual. Comets don't align with the elliptical plane, that flat disc-like ring which nearly all orbiting bodies around the sun are found. They have these wild, wide orbits that circle the sun in all directions, with no respect given to the elliptical plane, indicating that comets have a more mysterious origin than most bodies orbiting the sun who got in line on the elliptical plane long ago. Astronomers believe that many or most comets originate from the Oort cloud, the absolute furthest edge of our solar system. While Neptune is 30 astronomical units away from the sun, and the far edge of the Kuiper Belt is 50 astronomical units away from the sun, the inner edge of the Oort cloud is anywhere between 2,000 and 5,000 astronomical units away from the sun. And while that distance can be difficult to wrap your head around, the outer edge of the Oort cloud is even farther, anywhere from 10,000 to 100,000 astronomical units away from the sun. almost half the distance to the next closest star. This is the end of the sun's influence, the borders of its vast realm. The Oort cloud differs from the asteroid belt in the inner solar system and the Kuiper belt in the outer solar system because it also does not fall on the elliptical plane. Instead, the Oort cloud is wrapped around the sun in all directions, like a thin shell consisting of ancient ice and rock that can reach the size of mountains. These cold and distant bodies were likely pushed this far out at some point during the birth of the solar system, but not pushed out far enough to escape the subtle grasp of the sun. Somehow, some of these frozen remnants dislodged and found their way back towards the center of the solar system, the most likely cause for the unusual orbit of most comets. Being unable to find a meteorite that has come from a comet has been frustrating because it leaves important clues about understanding our solar system and universe in the dark. In 2002, one carbonaceous chondrite was found as a result of one of the many Antarctic searches named La Paz 02342. The La Paz meteorite was already known to be rare because it was carbonaceous, meaning it must have originated somewhere just beyond the orbit of Jupiter, because only that far out can organic material be protected from the blast that melted the majority of chondrites in the inner solar system. But the La Paz meteorite caught the attention of some researchers in 2019 when it was discovered material within the chondrite had a makeup most closely associated with comets, providing scientists with a rare opportunity to study the composition of these much more rare and distant asteroid cousins. The best guess as to how part of a comet found its way into a chondrite meteorite is that at some point a comet was brought into the inner solar system, collided with the carbonaceous chondrite in the early solar system, which then continued to form around the cometary material. Then, safely wrapped in its chondrite packaging, the cometary material was delivered to Earth and protected from burning up in the atmosphere while ultimately landing on the Antarctic ice sheet. La Paz was a rare find, but by itself, it would not tell us nearly enough about comets. Scientists knew that if they wanted to learn more, that they were going to have to leave this planet and chase after them. Chapter 13, Part 2, Riding Halley, the Giotto Mission. Space agencies from around the world have worked together to try and learn more about comets, which have resulted in 7 distinct comet missions so far. The first mission sent to a comet was done by the European Space Agency, or ESA, in coordination with the Soviet Union and Japan, With the launch of the Giotto spacecraft in 1985, Giotto's mission was to fly by the most famous comet known to Earth, Halley's Comet, as it approached the inner solar system, appearing in the skies over Earth in 1986. It was named for astronomer Edmund Halley, who correctly predicted its return after witnessing it in 1682 and stating that it would return about 75 years later. He also was the astronomer who put the call out for astronomers of the 1760s to observe the transit of Venus. The comet had captured the attention of people on Earth for thousands of years before Halley, but none predicted its regular return and why it was subsequently named after him. While fascination with Halley's Comet may go all the way back to the origin of humanity, the earliest possible recorded sighting of it may have been in 466 to 467 BCE, when the large meteorite, Aegospotami, was found by the ancient Greeks. Aegospotami is one of the more likely meteorites of the ancient times, as it was described as being the size of a wagon and brought people from the Mediterranean and Near East to visit it for over 500 years. While describing the fall of Aegospotami, the ancient Greeks who wrote about it noted that there was also a comet in the sky at the time, which some astronomers believe must have been Halley's Comet. As astronomers can pinpoint exactly when Halley would appear in the sky, it's possible that the Greeks hold the record for the earliest recorded sighting that has survived to modern day. But it is contested as to whether this was what the Greeks had really seen. Therefore, the first definitive sighting of the comet was in 240 BCE by Chinese astronomers, and ever since, it has been regularly recorded around the world. It was famously depicted in the Baya Tapestry, which illustrated the conquest of England by the Duke of Normandy in 1066. And after witnessing it in the sky in the year 1301, the renowned Florentine painter Giotto di Bondone created the famous Adoration of the Magi, which likely depicted Halley's Comet in the sky of the painting. Thus, the inspiration for the name of the spacecraft sent by ESA to study it. With each sighting of Halley's Comet throughout history, humans have likely imbued meaning on it, just as they have with all sky phenomena. Whether each sighting was an omen of dread and fear, like the visceral reaction of Brother Guy when he saw Comet West in the 1970s, whether it was a sign of honor and glory, like King Maximilian interpreted the meteorite at Ensisheim in 1492 before going on to defeat the French, or whether it was a message of spiritual connection to the universe, as the people of the island of Mur ascribe to fireballs they catch in the sky, each pass of Halley's Comet is suffused with the hopes, dreams, and fears of humanity. But with the launch of the ESA's Giotto mission, for the first time in history, we let Halley tell us about itself instead. The mission was a precarious one-time shot out into deep space, something that had never been done before, and which could have easily resulted in failure. First, there was the fact that the United States pulled out of being a part of the mission due to budget cuts. The United States' contribution to understand Halley were further undermined by the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger in 1986, which was carrying equipment to make observations on the comet, and had the resulting effect of canceling further missions for studying the comet. As the United States held the premier space program of the time, this was a huge blow for the GIATO mission, which needed as much funding and data about the comet as possible in order to succeed. The risks were even greater for ESA, as the GIATO mission was going to be Europe's first deep space mission. And if things did not go well, there was the fact that Halley couldn't be studied again until the year 2061, when it would next return from the depths of the outer solar system. For GIATO to be a success, it required an armada of deep space probes, which now had to come from somewhere else other than the United States. So ESA paired up with the Soviet Union and Japan, who provided two probes each for the mission. The two Soviet space probes, Vega 1 and Vega 2, launched in late 1984 and first stopped by Venus to study its atmosphere and geology before shooting off to study Halley's comet. But by August of 1985, Japan had launched their two probes, Suisei and Sakigake. The four probes would photograph and take measurements of Halley's comet to help GIATO's close approach to the comet succeed. All four missions were revolutionary and tested out important science regarding deep space and cometary equipment. The Vega probes, which reached Halley first, passed through the debris of its tail and was sending home valuable information on the composition of the comet. The dust mass spectrometer was detecting that Halley had a similar composition as carbonaceous chondrite meteorites that had been found on Earth, long been known to harbor elements that were essential for life. With the four probes in position and sending essential data back to Earth, it was time for GIATO's launch. Chances for failure were high, as GIATO was attempting to get closer to the comet than any other space probe, within 400 miles, which could shred the instruments and machinery on board. Within this range, dust particles would be shooting through space at over 150,000 miles per hour, speeds high enough to cross the Atlantic in only 11 minutes. Even wrapped in Kevlar, there was no guarantee that GIATO would survive such a close approach. And as GIATO neared, there were a few tense moments where contact was lost with the space probe as it was pummeled, moving through a particularly thick debris stream in Halley's wake. But as scientists on the mission held their breath, the data finally started coming in again, much to the team's relief. Close-up photographs of Halley's nucleus began to return home, along with further data on the composition of the comet. At about 9 miles long and 5 miles thick, the comet's nucleus was quite small compared to its thousands of miles span across the Earth's sky. It consisted of about 80% water vapor, with a smaller percentage of carbon monoxide and dioxide, as well as traces of hydrocarbons, methane, and ammonia. Giotto went on to study a second comet with its remaining power, known as Grigg-Skellerup, named after the pair that discovered it. All comets are named after people who contributed to their discovery. It was the discovery of organic materials such as water, carbon, and oxygen found by Giotto's comet missions that began new theories and questions of how life began on Earth. For a long time, the question of how so much water ended up on Earth had been debated. Could it have been a bombardment of icy comets? With all of the other organic materials found on Halley, was it possible that all of the essential elements for life could be found in comets? The results from the Giotto mission were promising. But the only way to find out were to send more probes. And that is exactly what happened. Chapter 13, Part 3. The Comet Race, Deep Space One, Stardust, Deep Impact, and Rosetta. The United States eventually climbed back on board with studying comets, beginning with NASA's Deep Space One probe, launched in 1998, primarily designed to research the asteroids Braille and Vesta. But it also made a flyby of Comet Borelli. In 1999, NASA launched its Stardust spacecraft to the comet Wild 2 to trail and collect samples from it in the same way that Giotto did with Halley. Only this time, Stardust would seal the particles up and do what dozens of meteor showers each year can't, and deliver the pieces safely back to Earth's surface to be studied. Stardust then went to check on a second comet, Tempel 1, which has a relatively regular orbit, at least compared to other comets, between Mars and Jupiter. Tempel 1 had already been visited by another spacecraft known as Deep Impact, launched in 2005 while Stardust was still busy studying Wild 2. Deep Impact released an 820-pound probe to crash into Tempel 1 to study the results, before moving on to study a second comet, Hartley 2. By the time the Stardust spacecraft reached Tempel 1, the dust had settled to reveal a 150-meter impact crater left behind by Deep Impact's probe. Deep Space One, Stardust, and Deep Impact all helped further our understanding of comets. But the most complex comet mission to date was once again pioneered by ESA with its Rosetta spacecraft. Launched in 2004, Rosetta promised to go one step farther than NASA's Deep Impact mission by sending a lander called Philae to touch down on Comet 67P. It took 11 years for Rosetta to finally reach 67P, equipped with fillet and over 20 different scientific instruments. Rosetta orbited the comet like a mini-satellite as 67P approached the sun, preparing to unleash its tail. After over a decade of work, the time to release the lander fillet had finally come. But all did not go as planned. Fillet landed in the wrong spot and instantly went into a months-long hibernation, where it was assumed all but dead. But then, one day, Fillet awoke and started transmitting data from the awkwardly shaped 2-mile-wide snowball. Meanwhile, Rosetta continued to orbit 67P and collect data as the comet approached the sun and started giving off its characteristic gaseous coma, the beginnings of its inner solar system tail. Together, Rosetta and Fillet were able to gather some of the best photographic and scientific data on comets. I share some of these pictures in my book, and they are truly stunning to look at. Rosetta flew as low as 8 miles above 67P to take some amazing close-up shots of this haunted and distant object. After 67P made its characteristic sling around the sun, the comet began to head back out of the inner solar system towards the orbit of Jupiter. As they receded back to the outer solar system, Rosetta wouldn't have enough power to continue observing 67P and was nearing its life's end. Mission successfully completed. On September 30th, 2016, ESA decided to do a controlled crash into the comet so Rosetta could rest for eternity on 67P with Fillet. To this day, 67P carries the remnants of this groundbreaking scientific expedition and will continue to travel with the comet for the rest of its existence, however long that will be. Between the NASA and ESA voyages, illuminating information began to emerge. One of the biggest pieces of news came from the samples returned to Earth by NASA's Stardust mission. The samples brought home by Stardust from Comet Wild 2 were not only composed of the expected organic materials, such as ice and carbon, interesting in their own right, but even the non-organic material of Wild 2 provided some profound insight as well. The rocky parts of the comet allowed scientists to glimpse into the formation of the early solar system about 4.6 billion years ago. They had expected to find a lot of pre-solar material from the time before the sun was born. But instead, they found that the rocky material from Wild 2 was heated up to temperatures so high that it could melt a brick. This has led some scientists to believe that places like the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud have a lot more debris from the forging of the sun than originally thought. If rocks out in the Kuiper Belt and Oort Cloud experienced temperatures this high, just as Wild 2 had, then they must have begun closer to the inner solar system and were later pushed out into more distant orbits. As they sat on the frigid fringes of the sun's grasp for the last 4.5 billion years, ice began to form on these remnants. The information brought back by Stardust was reshaping our understanding of the early solar system. But Wild 2 is only a single sample, and more information must be collected to better understand the process that occurred at the birth of the solar system. A call has gone out in recent years to continue missions to comets in order to help reveal the truths about our solar genesis. Yet, the mission that will top Rosetta's has not been announced by any space organization. Wild 2 had even more surprises in store that was brought back by the Stardust mission. The real stunner was that Wild 2 had a true amino acid found on it, glycine. Glycine is a critical building block of protein for life here on Earth. This supports the theory that comets may not only have delivered the large quantities of water that we have across the planet, but it also confirms that complex amino acids formed in space could also have been delivered by comets. Glycine is one of the critical components needed for life, found in both plant and animal life today. Glycine is used to make protein in most life, as well as being involved in sending chemical signals to the brain in humans. Further analysis ensured that the glycine found on Wild 2 was definitively extraterrestrial in origin, and ruled out the possibility that the amino acid was just an earthly contaminant. But the glycine found on Wild 2 was also quite simple. Not in a longer chain of the sort that you'd expect to find in a life form on Earth. This calls into question whether life could be formed by such basic elements and compounds created in space. In order to have all of the ingredients for life, 6 elements are needed: carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur, otherwise known as chenops. These elements began being detected on comets as far back as the Soviets' Vega and ESA's Giotto missions. But by the time of the Rosetta mission, one element from the group remained elusive in comets, and that was phosphorus. It's true that it was detected in Halley's Comet by Giotto, but it was written off as what they described as chemically unavailable, meaning that it was not the solid particles of phosphorus that would be necessary for life. It's also true that a single particle from Stardust's Wild 2 mission contained additional chemically unavailable phosphorus locked up in a mineral and also out of reach for life. What was needed to complete the chenops recipe was a type of phosphorus that was soluble to have played an essential role for the origin of life. It's known that on the early Earth, this soluble phosphorus was rare and would have complicated the initial creation of life if it wasn't available. Without soluble phosphorus nucleotides, amino acids, and phosphoglycerin, life would have had a much more difficult time beginning. But this sort of phosphorus was not found on Earth and seemed only likely to be delivered by meteorites or comets from space. But even Wild 2 didn't bring any new insights here. Then, the results of Rosetta's Mission 267P came in, and suddenly, the elusive soluble phosphorus that would have been so critical to the beginning of life on Earth was actually found. In addition to water and glycine, the finding of soluble phosphorus on 67P indicated that comets appear to be the perfect one-stop shop for all of life's most basic and fundamental needs. But there are limitations to this theory. Chiefly, the reason why we weren't able to collect comet samples here on Earth to begin with. They burn up. The sensitive materials for life riding in on a comet are likely to get vaporized and chemically altered as they are cooked in the atmosphere and pulverized by the ground. And that is if they even make it that far. Another mission like Stardust that collects further comet samples to return to Earth might be able to provide further answers about comets and their relationship to the origin of life on Earth. But for now, we have at least opened up the possibility that the first life on Earth was built with extraterrestrial ingredients. As comets go about their irregular orbits around the Sun, they also tend to lose a lot of mass, likely originating from the cold depths of the Kuiper Belt or Oort cloud, forces them to release a ton of frozen gases that cannot withstand the temperature of the Sun while they are in the inner solar system. But comets are slowly melting, like a snowman on a succession of warm days and cold nights. Since the origin of humanity about 200,000 years ago, it's likely that Halley's Comet has lost nearly 90% of its mass, and that it may be less than 25,000 years before the comet evaporates entirely. If this is true, the number of comets that existed over the course of the last 4.6 billion years could have been manifold, with sizes much larger than the comets that we're familiar with today. But wherever a comet goes in the inner solar system, they always leave a trail of debris behind them. Just like Swift Tuttle, Halley's Comet also leaves behind its debris for Earth to pass through with at least two meteor showers a year, the Eta Aquarius in early May and the Orionids in late October. But the meteor showers left by Halley and other comets don't compare to Swift Tuttle's annual Perseids, which continues to remain the top meteor shower to catch each year. Chapter 13, Part 4, Meteor Storms, the Leonids. The Perseids don't go down as providing the most brilliant meteor shower in history, though. That honor goes to the Leonids. Regularly scheduled for the month of November, the expected 15 meteors per hour Leonids typically don't outdo the up to 100 meteors per hour Perseids. Most meteor showers are like a light sprinkle compared to the Perseids' steady downpour of rock. Whether rocks are falling from the sky at 15 per hour or 100 per hour, they're all considered meteor showers. But sometimes, in rare circumstances, there can be a more powerful meteor storm. In order to technically qualify as a meteor storm, there needs to be many times the number of meteors falling than what is typically found during the Perseids. Even at its most active, the Perseids have topped out at about 300 meteors per hour back in 1993. In order to qualify as a meteor storm, there needs to be over 1,000 meteors per hour. In 1885, the Andromedids from Comet Biela produced 13,000 meteors per hour, nearly 5 times more than the Perseids on their best year. But it is the Leonids that can produce even more than that, because under the right conditions, the Leonids are better at producing meteor storms than all of the others. The Leonids come from a comet known as Temple-Tuttle, which is a different comet than Temple 1, studied by NASA's Deep Impact and Stardust missions. Both comets were discovered by the prolific astronomer Wilhelm Temple, along with 10 other comets, 5 minor planets, and multiple nebulae. Temple was not appreciated for his accomplishments as much as he should have been during his life, or even after his death. And he was never accepted by his peers, who saw him as an amateur and often dismissed his discoveries as inaccurate. Even though he often used cheaper and smaller equipment compared to the most famous astronomers of his day, he was still able to see things that they weren't on their larger and more expensive telescopes. Comet Temple-Tuttle orbits around the Sun once every 33 years, which makes most years the paltry light drizzle most commonly expected from the Leonids. In order to get a meteor storm, a fresh comet pass does the job best, and with Temple-Tuttle passing by once every 33 years, it provides the perfect opportunity. But this is no storm guarantee, as many 33-year cycles have come around only to disappoint storm hopers with the usual and unimpressive showers. While a 13,000 meteors per hour storm from the 1885 Andromedids was impressive, it was only a light storm when compared to what the debris from Temple-Tuttle can give. Reports of Leonid meteor storms go as far back as the year 902, where astronomers from China to Italy to Egypt reported that stars fell like rain. When the famed astronomer Johannes Kepler died in the month of November of 1630, the Leonids serendipitously lit up the sky on the night of his funeral. In 1799, Around the same time that Chladni's theory of meteorites was being debated, and the French believed that the Ensisheim meteorite had fallen from a mountainside, reports of another major Leonid meteor storm were reported. One person who observed the fall was the famed naturalist Alexander von Humboldt, younger brother of the Prussian minister Wilhelm von Humboldt, both of whom contributed significantly to the global scientific, political, and academic worlds. Alexander was one of the first to purport that South America and Africa had at one point been joined together in an age before plate tectonics were understood, and well before Robert Scott found the Glossopteris fossil over 100 years later. In his prescience, Humboldt was also one of the first to understand and describe human-induced climate change. Humboldt was exploring and mapping Venezuela at the time of the 1799 meteor storm, and wrote, quote, "The night between November 11th and 12th was calm and beautiful. During 4 hours, we observed thousands of huge fireballs, often with a brightness like Jupiter. Long smoke trails were left behind, lasting 7 to 8 seconds. Often the meteors exploded, leaving trails too." End quote. Humboldt also wrote about the observation from his fellow explorer, Amy Bonpland. Quote, "According to Bonpland's statement, right at the beginning of the apparition, no part of the sky was as large as 3 moons in diameter that would not have swarmed with fireballs and falling stars at any moment. From 4 o'clock onwards, the apparition gradually ceased." End quote. Many years later, Humboldt went on to write the prolific multi-volume treatise Cosmos, a term that he resurrected from the ancient Greeks, and the reason that we still use the term today. Having taken the time to see the Earth holistically in relationship to its connection to life and the universe, Humboldt had since inspired countless masses with his discoveries and insights. It was rumored that 33 years before the 1799 sighting, that a similar meteor storm had occurred in 1766. This led the nascent science of meteoritics, that was only just beginning to accept Chladni's theory at the beginning of the 19th century, to keep their eyes open in November of 1833 to see if there truly was a 33-year trend. And they were not disappointed. The 1833 Leonid meteor storm often goes down as the greatest meteor storm in recorded history, where they saw anywhere from 70,000 to more than 100,000 meteors per hour falling from the sky. Even during the best Perseid shower, it's lucky to see one meteor per minute. But on the night of Tuesday, November 12th, and the early morning of Wednesday, November 13th, 1833, people were seeing 20 to 30 meteors per second. People must have awoken from their sleep by the incredulous onlookers that just happened to be awake. In South Carolina, people lay on the ground with their hands in the air, gesticulating and pleading for God to save them. Elsewhere, others fainted, believing it was the end of days. One astronomer wrote, quote, "On the night of November 12th to 13th, 1833, a tempest of falling stars broke over the earth. The sky was scored in every direction with shining tracks and illuminated with majestic fireballs. At Boston, the frequency of meteors was estimated to be about half that of flakes of snow in an average snowstorm. Their numbers were quite beyond counting." End quote. From Missouri, writers like Bruna McGuire and Betty Wall wrote, quote, "The stars showered down so thickly and fast that it looked as though every star in the heavens was falling. When they touched the ground, they burst and drifted away. Stars were still falling when the sun arose the next morning. Never before had there been such a sight witnessed, nor has there been since the greatest meteoric display of our age." End quote. Inventor, physicist, and astronomer Dennison Olmsted was awakened by his neighbors in Connecticut and witnessed the event that evening. He noticed that the meteors tended to all originate from a single point in the sky, which he termed as the radiant. Interestingly, he would also invent the term radiator to describe a man-made heating device. To this day, all meteor showers are named for the constellation they seem to radiate from, as it was not yet understood that comets were the causes of the showers. The Leonids radiate from the part of the sky which holds the constellation Leo, and the Perseids radiate from the constellation Perseus. As a Yale professor, Olmsted recognized the scientific value of what had just occurred and immediately reached out to the local newspaper, the New Haven Daily Herald, to ask the public at large for their testimonial about the previous night's phenomenon. Quote, "As the cause of falling stars is not understood by meteorologists, it is desirable to collect all the facts attending this phenomenon, stated with as much precision as possible." End quote. This effort by Olmsted is considered the birth of citizen science, or crowdsourcing for scientific data, a technique regularly employed particularly by space scientists to help pore over the overwhelming amount of data they have to sift through. Letters about what had been seen on that fateful night began pouring in shortly after his article. Olmsted was fascinated by the 1833 event and began to challenge conventional thinking on the origin of meteors at the time, based on all the evidence that came into him from that night. Olmsted came to the same conclusion about meteorites that Chladni did over three decades earlier, that the meteor storm's origin must come from outer space. At this time, Aristotle's belief that meteors were just bubbles of gas that ignited, perhaps electrified by lightning in the upper atmosphere, was still held as a reasonable explanation as to the cause of meteor showers. But with the help of all of the letters he received from his public plea, he was able to determine that meteor showers were seen nationwide and were the result of the influence of gravity, not strange gases. He learned that farmers had been paying attention to meteor shower cycles for centuries, even while scientists were overlooking it. There are two famous depictions of the grand 1833 Leonid meteor storm. The most famous is a woodcut by Adolf Volmi, and the second is an illustration that appeared in a book, Image Atlas of the Star World, by Edmund Weiss. The black and white Volmi woodcut depicts a rural village on a dark starlit night, with hundreds of meteors showering down like sheets of rain, while townsfolk gaze up at the sky in awe and wonder. The illustration appearing in Weiss's atlas was a color painting of Niagara Falls at night with hills and a distant glow of sunrise on the horizon. The still dark night is also lit with stars as the moon set early the night before. In the illustration, dozens of rainbow-colored balls of light with long tails fall from the sky, sparking and jutting into new trajectories, the colors from the fireballs being reflected in the Niagara River. Both the Volmi woodcut and the Weiss illustration are stunning works of art depicting the 1833 meteor storm, and I've shared both of them in my book. But neither was done around the time of the storm. The Volmi woodcut was produced in 1888, and the Weiss Atlas was released in 1892, 55 and 59 years after the event, respectively. While we know there were countless meteors falling from the sky every second, it most likely did not look quite like the Volmi woodcut. And while some of the meteors definitely cracked and broke apart in a colorful display, they were not as perfectly rainbow-hued as depicted in the 1892 Atlas. The 1833 meteor storm is often cited as the largest recorded meteor storm to ever occur, so we can only rely on artistic representations like the Volmi woodcut and Weiss's painting in a time before night photography existed to get a sense of what they saw. It may be that these representations created over a half a century later is the closest that we can get to understanding what a massive meteor storm must have looked like. One lesser-known woodcut created by an editor at Mechanics Magazine claimed to have witnessed it over Niagara Falls personally and included a radiant within it. I've also shared that image as well in my book. And over the next century, there would be more Leonid meteor storms, but none would ever reach the fever pitch of that famed night in 1833. Many ex-slaves in the United States and Caribbean shared stories about what they called the night the stars fell, with one African-American quilt that depicts the event ending up in the Smithsonian. One oral story passed down described how the slave owners called for their slaves that night, and, to the sudden surprise of the slaves, began telling them, for apparently no reason, where they had sold off their family members. The tragic family separations by slave owners was a common practice, and to ensure that no one would try and escape to find them, the owners just withheld where they went. So when the owners suddenly decided to release this precious information on that bizarre night in 1833, family members celebrated joyously while, quote, big stars were coming down real close to the ground, and just before they hit the ground, they would burn up, end quote. So why the sudden change in heart by the slave owners? According to this oral story, quote, you see, they thought it was Judgment Day, end quote. According to Walt Whitman, Abraham Lincoln invoked the 1833 Leonid Storm during what Whitman called the gloomiest period of the war, when one member of a large delegation of bank presidents asked whether, quote, his confidence in the permanency of the Union was not beginning to be shaken, end quote. Lincoln replied with the following story, quote, when I was a young man in Illinois, I boarded for a time with a deacon of the Presbyterian Church. One night I was roused from my sleep by a rap at the door, and I heard the deacon's voice exclaiming, arise, Abraham, the day of judgment has come. I sprang from my bed and rushed to the window, and saw the stars falling in great showers. But looking back of them in the heavens, I saw all the grand old constellations with which I was so well acquainted, fixed and true in their places. Gentlemen, the world did not come to an end then, nor will the Union now. End quote. The 1833 Leonids left such an impression that Abraham Lincoln invoked them decades later as the closest thing he could remember that felt as doom-ridden as a literal war. Therefore, astronomers waited with anticipation for the theorized 33-year cycle that these Leonid storms were believed to come by. And in 1868, while a powerful Leonid storm did take place, it did not compare to that unforgettable night in 1833. After that, the expected 33-year cycle that astronomers were coming to rely on was falling apart. As following 33-year storm years came and went, nothing more fell than the paltry couple dozen an hour levels that Leonids do during a typical year. By the 20th century, the 1833 storm was nothing but a distant memory, and it seemed like it was a fluke, and that nothing that size and scope would ever happen again. But in 1966, the record-setting numbers of the 1833 storm were apparently trounced. In the early hours of Thursday morning on November 17, 1966, a rather mediocre meteor shower suddenly intensified to storm levels. For most of the previous night and that morning, the Leonids were no more intense than a few dozen meteors spotted per hour at best, leaving many who were waiting up expectantly for a meteor storm to go to bed early. Even worse, many places in the eastern United States had cloud cover blocking any chance at seeing whatever show was to occur. But as dawn began to approach along the eastern seaboard, and darkness still reigned in the clear skies out west, people all across the United States began witnessing the true greatest meteor storm in recorded history. This time, Dr. Peter Kenneskins, author of Meteor Showers and Their Parent Comets, and senior research scientist at the SETI Institute, was the one who collected testimonials of that fateful night in homage of Olmsted. Here are some excerpts of what people saw. Richard Nolthenius from Santa Cruz, California, said, quote, "We left about midnight and made it out past Barstow on Interstate 15 about 2 a.m. Pacific time, still beneath the solid clouds. Then a small hole opened up around Perseus and we pulled over. Within just a few seconds, I saw a meteor, and not long after, another and another. The hole opened wider, and now I could see there was a Leonid coming every second. And within a few minutes, it was clear the rate was climbing. What unbelievable luck! The meteor rate climbed dramatically, and there were occasional fireballs, one as bright as a quarter moon, and leaving a twisted, strange tail for a very long time. Others exploded behind the few remaining clouds, creating bright rims. It was an unearthly scene. By now, cars, trucks, and even the big 18-wheelers were pulled over to the side of the road to watch the show." End quote. Greg Arnquist of Seattle, Washington, said, quote, "My mother woke me up around 2 in the morning. We went out in the front yard and I was amazed because there were numerous shooting stars filling the sky at any one moment. I was awestruck and it became a wonderful memory that has been one of most unique, since I love to tell this story. Many people find it hard to believe, but I could hear some of them burning up in the atmosphere. My mom and I spent a long time out there, thoroughly stunned by the experience." End quote. Mike Jones of Shelton, Washington, wrote in, quote, "I was in Army Primary Flight School at Fort Walters near Mineral Wells, Texas at the time. As my eyes adjusted to the dark, I noticed meteors streaking down at an alarming rate. I ran back in the barracks and soon had a bunch of us all staring up into the night sky. The rate picked up very rapidly, and soon we were seeing dozens of meteors every second. The effect was similar to watching snowflakes race at your windshield while driving in a snowstorm. Very intense. It was a spectacle I'll never forget." End quote. And Carl Moyer Jr. from Richardson, Texas, said, quote, "For whatever reason, we were on the second floor balcony outside our apartment when someone noticed a meteor streak overhead. The show of meteors increased to almost a crescendo in frequency. It was fascinating and kept us on the balcony for at least 3 hours. To see them streaking across the sky at an uncountable rate was a memorable moment. This was highlighted by a single meteor of which I've yet to hear anyone describe. Time was probably between 2:30 and 4 a.m. It started the same as any of them, but instantly it was different. The trajectory seemed to be from overhead directly toward our location. It grew in size rapidly until it appeared to be the size of the sun. The surrounding area, as far as one could see, was lit up just like noon. The brain's first and immediate reaction was that it was going to hit the ground. I'm sure we were all gasping. When even with the horizon, as if it were about to impact, there was a loud bang and it winked out as rapidly as it appeared. The event was so brief it seemed as if someone just set off a flashbulb. Sure burned the image into my brain. End quote. And then there was Bruce Weaver from Bradenton, Florida, who wrote, quote, "The whole event was absolutely phenomenal. I witnessed two bolides that morning in which, when they exploded, it was the equivalent of daylight for a brief instant. Incredible. The first exploded behind me. I followed the second one down and it exploded in front and center to my eastward vantage point. Unfortunately, as the storm seemed to be intensifying, daylight began intruding. However, I will never forget one further remarkable lingering phenomena that I have not seen duplicated since. In the vicinity of the upper part of Virgo and just south of Denebola, a large bright cloud appeared to be growing in intensity. At the time, I wondered if I was seeing the zodiacal light. In retrospect, I am convinced that this bright area of enormous size I viewed as a mysterious parting accompaniment was the meteoric cloud from which the ultimate swarm fireworks later exploded, perhaps highlighted by the early morning sun. As a footnote, one of my friends, Gary Fleming, was president of our Southeast High School Astronomy Club, had also observed the meteoric spectacle. While in his high school classroom that morning, he was looking out the window and witnessed a meteor falling in broad daylight. Utterly captivated, he instinctively stood up in awe. His teacher, oblivious to the extraordinary circumstance this upperclassman was responding to, blurted out, "Gary, sit down." End quote. In all, it was calculated that the 1966 Leonid meteor storm fell at a rate between 80,000 and 150,000 meteors per hour, which is about twice the rate of the 1833 storm. The account by the flight school attendee Mike Jones, where he described the feeling of snowflakes racing at your windshield while driving through a snowstorm, was repeated in many accounts, and no doubt what Denison Olmsted witnessed when he coined the term radiant to describe that location where all the meteors seemed to be emanating from. In an article for the Journal of the British Astronomical Association describing the 1966 Leonids, one person noted that, quote, "Looking directly at the radiant gave the effect of depth of the Earth moving through space," end quote. Another eyewitness account stated that, quote, "I felt as if the Earth itself were moving through space towards the constellation Leo," end quote. The number of meteors were so many as to give the impression of feeling the Earth driving through space. Since 1966, we've been able to identify incoming meteor storms better because streams left by comets, particularly Comet Temple-Tuttle, are well known. The guessing game of the 33-year rule is less accurate today than listening to actual scientific predictions of those who have made it their life's work to study meteor showers and storms. The next time we're likely to see a Leonid meteor storm will be in the year 2034. But even if it reaches the storm level of 1,000 meteorites per hour, it will likely not be a repeat of 1966 or 1833. In space, comets are subject to the whims and wills of larger gravitational bodies, and Jupiter's effect on Temple Tuttle has ensured that it will not be leaving 1833 or 1966 level storms for Earth anytime over the next century. Thank you for listening to this episode of No Character Limit. Every episode, the sources that I used are located in the description if you would like to check them out. In addition, please consider liking, rating, and reviewing if you enjoyed this podcast, as each one goes to help further the reach of this podcast for new people to hear. Each episode requires hours in research, writing, recording, and editing. So if you feel that what you just heard is worth a donation of any size, please go to the description and follow the links for that. Each donation comes with a free PDF copy of a writing piece of your choice, no matter the size of your donation, and you get a lot of extra features with that, including a lot of the artwork and graphs and pictures, as well as the descriptions that I don't include in the podcast. If you would like updates for new episodes, you can follow No Character Limit at mastodon.world. And finally, if you have a question, comment, or even a correction, please feel free to reach out at nocharacterlimit@protonmail.com. Thank you again for listening.